Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello, welcome to The Onyears. I'm Amy Walter. When the Supreme Court released their decision to limit the scope and scale of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in late April, I knew I wanted to dig into the political and legal repercussions of that decision with someone who is well-versed in both politics and the law. And to my mind, there's no one better than Sean Trendy. He's a senior analyst at Real Clear Politics and an actual lawyer who has deep expertise in redistricting law. In fact, back in 2022, Sean was one of two special masters assigned to draw Virginia's congressional maps. He's also an astute analyst of political trends and elections, and it doesn't hurt that he lives in Ohio, a key epicenter for the battle for the Senate this year. But as fate would have it, we recorded this just a couple days before the Virginia Supreme Court struck down the Virginia map voters had approved earlier this spring. So while we weren't able to address that case directly, we did talk about the possibility of this very scenario and its broader impact on maps for 2026. But overall, my goal for this interview was to look past the immediate and into the broader issues that this Supreme Court decision and the tit-for-tat redistricting wars could have on our politics in the near and far term. By the way, for the latest developments, the back and forth, all the details on redistricting and its impacts on 2026, you can find all of your answers at cookpolitical.com's redistricting tracker, which my colleague Aaron Covey is constantly updating. Okay, here's my conversation with Sean Trendy. We recorded it on Wednesday, May 6th. Sean Trendy, it's so great to see you. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Oh, thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are the guru of all things involving redistricting. So, of course, we have to start this conversation looking at the Voting Rights Act decision from last week, the Supreme Court's decision in Calais versus Louisiana. And I want to just go start here. I want to note something that you have said both on your podcast as well as something you wrote on X, which is, the fact that 99% of the discourse about this case is the effect on Dems and their ability to win the House is kind of wild, you said. And then you said, it's supposed to be a law about minority voting rights, not who can control Congress. So can you help us pull that apart? Because it sure feels very partisan, especially as, while we are recording this, we see Republican legislatures and Republican governors in Tennessee and Alabama and Louisiana go into special session to try and redraw lines, which will benefit ultimately Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in our country, race and politics are correlated. So
yep.
I don't think anyone's acting in bad faith or anything like that, but I think it says something about our discourse that so much of the attention immediately went to there won't be Democrats in these states versus, you know, black voters won't have a candidate of choice
right
in these states. And
yeah.
I actually think, I hate to psychoanalyze the justices, but I actually think that is part of why Calais came out the way it is. I think it's part of why the racial gerrymandering jurisprudence has gone the way it's gone. You know, now you have to bring a racial gerrymandering suit, you have to draw a map that shows that all of the objectives, including political objectives, could have been achieved without relying on race. And so I think what the court is kind of thinking, and it shows up in this discourse, is a lot of this really is political lawsuits dressed up. I think there are people who absolutely bring good faith lawsuits in this. I will never say an ill word about Nina Perales at MALDEF. She is awesome in fighting for Latino representation. But I think the court feels like it's being dragged into a political thicket. And if you look at it through that lens, the political gerrymandering case, Rucho, the racial gerrymandering case, and this case all line up, which is the court just wants out of this. It doesn't want another Bush v. Gore where it finds itself in charge of litigating a case that can decide control of the House. And it is just, at this point, wants to turn it over to the political branches. Now, I don't know that that's right. I'm kind of tepid on this decision at best. But I think that is a big part of what's lurking in the background here.
And let's sort of pull that out one more layer to thinking about how Democrats react to this politically, right? If the argument is this is a gutting of protections for Black and Latino lawmakers, right? Or it will basically oust generations of these political figures. Will that then limit the ways in which Democrats go about redistricting in the future? For example, you know very well, you could go into a state like New Jersey and take those districts that now are heavily Latino, heavily Black, and if you spread them out, you could probably help Democrats politically, but it might not ensure that you get a Black or Latino representative. Is that about right?
Yeah, so the intra-coalitional fights in the Democratic Party, I think, are going to be fascinating.
Yeah.
Because to use an example, you know, I have no doubt that you can flip all four districts on, well, I guess you only have to flip two districts on Long Island by drawing them into Queens. Matter of fact, Gary Ackerman's district in the 90s did just that, right? It went along Suffolk, the north, kind of skipped along the northern, north of Long Island from Suffolk to Queens. The question, though, becomes, like, is Flushing going to put up with that? Like, how far is Representative Meng willing to see the Asian vote in her district dip down? And I don't know. I don't put that out there. Is no way they're going to go along with it. The Terry Sewell from Alabama was actually pretty enthusiastic
yep.
about something like
yep.
that.
Yeah.
You know, but will, I don't know, is it still Representative Meeks in the Southeast Queens District, Gregory Meeks, or has he been replaced?
Maybe. Gosh, this is, we've been to, we're professionals, we're supposed to know this. This is why I have Erin Covey. She can answer all of those questions for me. But basically, we're getting at really the central question here, which is this an issue of ensuring that people of color have the opportunity to run and win elections for Congress and in many of these state legislatures, et cetera? Or is this about one party represents the interests of Black voters better than the other, and so we have to ensure that that happens, right? And isn't that at the core the debate? Because when I look at all of the districts that right now are held by Black representatives, almost half are in districts that are 40% or more Black. So you can get elected in districts that have fewer, but I guess that becomes the question then. Is it a requirement for a district to be above a certain percentage Black in order for it to be considered
an opportunity district for a person of color to run in?
Yeah, there's all kinds of statistical techniques that experts use to determine, like, what is the threshold that a district has to have to elect a minority candidate of choice. You know, you look at how polarized the voting is in primaries as well as general yep. elections. And sometimes it can be really severe. I mean, in the Michigan case, you know, the Michigan State House and Senate were struck down as racial gerrymanders, but there was also a Voting Rights Act claim. And so Mallory McMorrow, who's running for Senate, was actually put into the same district as a black state senator in 2022. And when you break down the primary vote, like 96% of white voters in that district voted for McMorrow, and something like 85% of the black voters in that district voted for the black state senator. So you do sometimes get pretty severe racial polarization, even today in Democratic primaries. And that is just going to be a huge fight within the Democratic Party, because at the end of the day, you know, you and I follow what's going on with the CBC as close as anyone. And a lot of the members are very loyal Democrats, but when the rubber hits the road, there's a diversity of opinion on, you know, what happens if something gets pushed that harms the interests of my constituents
right.
that the National Democratic Party wants. There really are genuine issues that split that coalition, and it's going to be at the core of these fights over redistricting.
100%. And look, Sean, I'm old enough to remember how redistricting used to be in the long ago days before we didn't have Twitter and the intense focus on all of this from all different corners of the social and political sphere, whatever. But the point is, I remember when you would talk to folks who were line drawing, it was a very personal process and it was very parochial. Right. And folks would get upset, understandably, whether they were in a district that was going to get heavily redrawn or not. They didn't want anything to happen that was going to potentially make their lives as an incumbent harder. Right. So if you move this community out of my district, that's my home base. I don't like it, even though on paper it's still a 70% plus D or R district. That is my community. You can't move that, right? What feels different, and I'm curious what you will say about this, is that I look at a place like California, and you have members there who, on the Democratic side, are losing very significant chunks of their old districts and didn't push back for a minute on this map. So are the parochial days gone and everybody just comes in basically saying this is a national fight?
So something you said, we were, I don't know if on a panel together or doing speeches or something you said maybe 6-7 years ago really resonated with me, which is that the kind of texture of our job has gone away. Like, there was a time you needed to know that, like, John Dingell always looked out for the auto industry, and that Connie Morella was a Republican, but she would vote with the Democrats, you know, 70% of the time, but maybe more for Republicans in committee. You needed to know, and nowadays you don't need to know that stuff, because it's just, there's still some of it, right? Like, Susan Collins is still a senator. And,
right.
But those are special cases. Like, we can rattle off those cases. And I think I was flabbergasted with it. And I would imagine one of the big kind of miscalculations on the RNC side when they went ahead with Texas, I was flabbergasted that everyone went along with it. And I think they,
me too,
you know, there's no way they're going to get the members to go along with it.
Me too.
There's still some of that. I've been involved in draws where, you know, you draw a beautiful map and then they're like, well, okay, you can't do that because this representative wants all of that county. And you're like, well, what difference does it make? Like, it's not his home. Well, he just doesn't want to have to mess with figuring out, like, where his district line is. He knows to campaign in the entire county. Well, Can you tell him to pound sand? No, he chairs the Ways and Means Committee, and he's really mean. And so, if you don't give him what he wants, he's going to defund the entire state. Like, that still exists.
And it still exists. Look, it happened in for all the talk of Indiana. We're talking, by the way, the day after Indiana legislators who opposed the White House redistricting effort, Republicans who opposed it, most of them lost re-election because they got pummeled by national Republican funding. But there were examples. Kansas did not go along with a push. Kansas legislators could have drawn out another Democratic seat. In Maryland, obviously, Wes Moore's push to get the lines redrawn were rebuffed. Same with Nebraska. Republicans didn't go in and redraw Omaha. So there were still some of those examples where we're hearing it too in South Carolina. There's some pushback about redrawing Jim Clyburn's seat. So you're right. There still are some of those special relationships, but it feels like they are fewer and fewer.
Yeah, absolutely. I even in Virginia, I was surprised that they were just like, hey, let's split Fairfax County five ways, right? Because in a way, that's bad for representation, right? Like Fairfax County now has, its diluted strength, and these maps, they're great, assuming they stand, they're great in a year like 2026. But the idea that in 2028 or 2030, those representatives aren't going to have to pay attention to the rural areas is just wrong. Possibly. I mean, maybe it's going to be three Democratic waves in a row, but...
But that's where we are. And I want to talk about Virginia specifically because you're the guy, along with one other special master, who drew those original maps. Those were 6-5 maps. We now have a ostensibly 10-1 map today. And right before the vote, you also said something I noted, which was you said, look, at the end of the day, I don't know that it's really a big deal or not if these maps pass. Because the bigger picture is that it may not be as relevant in 2028 as it is today. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been staying out of the Virginia stuff because I, along with Bernie Grofman, I'd drawn the maps. And I figured anything I said one way or the other was going to be seen as trying to either influence the vote or just sour grapes. And so there's this moment where it looked like it was genuinely 50-50 whether the map was going to pass or not. And most of the votes have been cast at that point. So I was like, you know what, I can give my thoughts. And look, in this year, I think most people thought Jen Kiggins was in real trouble to begin with.
Right.
Like, and that seat was drawn in such a way that in a good Democratic year, they could win it. And so it would be 7-4. And I think if things really get out of control, Whitman's district had a chance of flipping the kind of, the next and then Chesterfield County. So really over baseline, it was probably a couple, 2 to 3 Democratic seats, not 4, since that Kiggins was more or less banked, I think. But the other thing is that it's a 55-45 state, and there aren't but so many ways you can slice it up. It's really hard to slice it up 10 ways that will reliably elect Democrats. A lot of those districts are really like, I don't know, guys, like if you were to encounter a 2010 or, even a 2022 environment, absent Dobbs, like a lot of those districts, I think, are very marginal. The 10th district was a Biden 20 district, but the Democrat there had a couple of really close races.
Right.
22 and 24. And as far as I can tell, all of these seats are drawn closer. Maybe a couple of them are more than Biden 20, but I don't know. If you had redistricting giveth and it taketh away.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And I guess, Sean, the question I get asked a lot, and I'm sure you do too, which is, are we now in a never-ending arms race on redistricting? And do you believe that even though a state like Virginia and a state like California has said these are temporary measures, Do you really believe that we're going to go back, see Democratic states go back to nonpartisan redistricting commissions?
I have a hard time buying it. And just for a very pragmatic reason, which is, let's say the California map performs all 3 years, 48 yeah. Democrats. And California loses a couple seats in redistricting.
Yep. Yep.
Are they really going to tell, now we go to an independent redistricting commission, are they really going to say to seven Democratic incumbents, fair game,
we got to go to fair maps. Yeah.
And same, let's say this is a 10-1 Virginia map in 2030. Are you really going to tell four Democratic incumbents, you got to go home now, you had a good run? I just have a hard time.
I agree.
Buying it.
Especially with the VRA decision and the fact that they're going to point to Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee, et cetera, and say, well, they've now gutted all of these districts. We can't possibly, right? We can't disarm at this moment. But what about down the line? There are other blue states, New York, Colorado, that have commissions that theoretically could be disbanded. Is that where you think this goes next for Democrats?
Yeah, I think Colorado almost certainly goes. They can draw four Republicans out there pretty easily, assuming all four survive this cycle.
Right.
Three, probably, since Colorado 8 probably flips. In New York, we know what they think, right? The first thing they did, given control of redistricting, was to pass that 24-4 map that their own court struck down, 4-3. They desperately want to get rid of that now that New York has become so blue and upstate has become blue enough they don't have to worry about losing the state Senate. I would be absolutely shocked if that commission survives.
And so where does this leave us? We are now redistricting every 2 years, that the census doesn't matter, if you're going to take both a practical and a philosophical perspective on this, Sean.
Yeah, obviously it depends on having the trifecta, but anymore, most states have trifectas. That's control of the House, Senate, and executive. I think that's probably where we're going. I hate it. I used to love reading the almanac and learning about the districts and this is Virginia always had the Arlington district, the Fairfax district, the Loudoun West district, right? Exactly, 8-10-11,
yep.
Or the other way around, 8-11-10, regardless. And from just a philosophical perspective, that made sense. Yep. We have districts and not proportional representation for a reason. And that is, area matters. Different locales have their own needs that they need people to represent. I could go all the way back to Madison, but I'll spare your listeners that. And that's just gone, right? Now it's spaghetti strip districts, and they don't really have any geographic reason or rhyme to them. They're going to get redrawn every time that people get a chance. And I think gerrymandering in general is bad, but this extreme gerrymandering where your districts just don't mean anything anymore is really corrosive. Because when we talked about what we talked about before, members wanted the gas station that their cousin owned in the district. It was because they had a real tie to that area and they were going to advocate for that area. And that's just all gone. And so you're just going to have people that all that matters is that they're Republicans or Democrats and they can get Republican or Democratic votes.
A quick break and we'll be back with Sean Trendy. Hey there, it's Erin Covey, the House Editor here at the Cook Political Report. Did you know we have another podcast called Editor's Roundtable? It comes out once a week and features me and my colleagues pulling back the curtain to let you in on all of our insights on races, ratings changes, polling, and everything else we'll be following this midterm year. You can find Editor's Roundtable on Apple Podcasts for just $1.99 a month or become a paying subscriber to our new Cook Political Report Substack. All this is linked in the episode's show notes.
I want to transition, Sean, because you're also an expert on all things election-oriented, and I want to talk about the Senate. And I have to say, in just reading, and if you're not following Sean, by the way, you should be on X/Twitter, because I find your insights really, really helpful. This is an even-keeled, normal person, for as normal as you can be, covering politics. And that's why I've been somewhat surprised. So tell me if I'm wrong on this, but my read of your take right now on the Senate is that it is much more precarious for Republicans than some Republicans are admitting. Is that a fair way to say that?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a contrarian streak. And so
as soon as
Republicans went above 50% on Cauchy, I felt like, okay, hold your roll. Like, I don't want to overstate it, but I think Cauchy aside, like, among professionals, there's still a sense like, come on, guys. And that was our original take at the start of the cycle. It was like, okay,
right.
I could see Democrats doing North Carolina. I could see them doing Maine, certainly. But come on, then you're talking about like Ohio, Texas, maybe Alaska. And yet here we are today. And I think all those states are genuine opportunities. And where I really kind of get bullish on Democrats is I can tell you why I think Sherrod Brown comes up short, or why Tallarico comes up short, or Peltola. But I also think one of them is going to get through in this environment. And I could just see two of them getting through. Like, I don't know that any one of them is favored, but when you look at it all together, and it's shocking that, like, we're talking about, these are Trump 11, 12, 13 states.
Yeah. And that's my question for, if we can drill down on Ohio for a minute, because you are an Ohio resident and you know that state very well. What needs to happen in order for Sherrod Brown to come back and win? What does that math look like?
So the case for Sherrod Brown is that Democrats, the reason that Ohio flipped from swing to Republican is that Appalachia and then the Youngstown area swung towards Republicans, right? Trump is like the first Republican since the 1920s to carry Mahoning County for president. But that's Sherrod Brown's stomping grounds. And his brand as a Democrat is, he's liberal, but he fights for these people, right?
Right.
He's like an old Lane Evans Democrat. Give a real throwback there. And so the case is that he pulls it off in Youngstown in Appalachia. Doesn't necessarily win, but keeps the Republican margins down. And then he is able to kind of leverage the suburbs, like Delaware County, Geauga County, those places, the increasing Democratic strength in the suburbs.
Now,
the
Columbus.
The problem he runs into, just to kind of give both sides, is that, if this were Sherrod versus Bernie Moreno or J.D. Vance, I would say, actually, I think he has a very good chance. But the Republicans have John Husted, who's kind of still part of the old normie Republican dynasty, right? Like, he's very much in the John Kasich pre-presidential Mike DeWine mold, who can still put up good numbers in the suburbs. And so it's really going to just be a question of, voters fired Sherrod Brown a couple years ago. John Husted is inoffensive, relatively speaking. Does the national environment wipe that out in the suburbs, and Sherrod Brown can put his old coalition back together in the working class areas?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, even when Sherrod Brown did defeat a normie Republican, which was he beat Mike DeWine in 2006, that was a state that George W. Bush had carried the election before by only 4 points or less than 4 points, right? And so the Ohio of 2006, in which Sherrod Brown was able to oust a sitting incumbent Republican, is very, very different. I guess that's a question for you, Sean, as you think about a state like Ohio, Iowa, Texas, and to a certain degree Alaska, but let's take Alaska out of there for just a second. The movement to Republicans has been significant, as you know, since 2012 in all in the Ohio and Iowa portions of that trifecta. How much of that do you think is a reaction to Trump, and how much of that is permanent?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, nothing's permanent, right? Things change all the time.
But... Right. But can live beyond Trump, and that maybe it won't be a whoever the next Republican nominee is wins Iowa by 13. But is it, are you pretty much now like, okay, the worst you can do as a Republican there is you win by 3 or 4, right?
So I actually, one of my theories that I've never really, I don't know if I've ever really put out there, but that Trump was foreshadowed in 2014, right? That was the year we were like, well, you know, maybe Pryor can hold on in Arkansas because there's still a Democratic coalition.
Right.
Lost by like 20 points to Tom Cotton.
And right.
So, I can't think of the Democratic nominee against Ernst.
It was Louisiana. And wasn't that also Mary Landrieu was that year, right, in Louisiana? Yeah. And who else did we have? It was all the, yeah, it was those Southern, and it was Joni Ernst in Iowa.
Started out, she is like, we have this state senator running against Bruce Braley, you know, a member of Congress. You know, he said he had that awful quote. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Wasn't it about lawyers? Like, I'm smarter than farmers because I'm a lawyer, or something like that. Like, I'm not some dumb farmer.
Yeah,
I can't remember. It's something in that category.
Yeah, but Ernst ends up winning that. It wasn't particularly close. And so if you look at a lot of those races, they kind of, A, the polls were off, so it kind of foreshadowed 2016 that way. But that's, I think Trump certainly reinforces that coalition, but that coalition had started to emerge before him. That coalition is part of why Trump became the Republican nominee, is that a lot of kind of rural populist Democrats had started voting in Republican primaries during the Obama years. So the kind of counter in Iowa in particular is that it's got like a mini recession going on because of the tariffs. But generally speaking, I think, you know, I mean, Ohio, even in 2018, all the statewide Republicans won. In 2022, everyone except J.D. Vance won by 20 points. Like, I think there are just like real foundational changes that last. That doesn't mean they can never be overcome when you have a Republican president with a, you know, sub 40% approval rating, but that's what it takes for it to happen.
That's a very good point. And yet on the governor's race in Ohio, also a very interesting matchup there. The last Democratic governor of Ohio, Ted Strickland, right? And that was
one term.
Tell me how you assess this matchup between, this is Vivek Ramaswamy and Amy Acton.
You get these sometimes in politics. It is one of those like irresistible force meets the immovable object elections, because you have a state that's basically Republican. Amy Acton is known to everyone as the face of the state's COVID response.
Right.
And that, especially in the types of places that Democrats have to flip, like Youngstown and Appalachia, like that is just the worst thing you can be. And worse still, she wasn't around when the state opened up. Like, Mike DeWine got credit for opening the state early. But she was no longer on the TV every night.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you. Like, people would know her. She was the one that, okay, so if you live in Ohio, you know, when the schools closed, that was the face on your screen telling you it wasn't safe and that you had to wear masks, right? All of that.
So Mike DeWine would do these like daily briefings. It was really effective. Like, it was what Trump was trying to be, but you know, Mike DeWine was very sober and he would have but there would always be Amy Acton on with him, like explaining why we need to do this. And so that is the only way. Like, people were picketing her house. Like, they knew where she lived and like it was actually becoming a security issue. And so people have a visceral response to that. And if you look at the fights we're still having over things like vaccines, and people remember that. you know, I'll put out that I'm vaccinated, I wore my mask, like, this isn't my fight. I just know that people care about that. On the other hand, the Republican nominee is Vivek, and he's just not a terribly likable guy. You know, we can, again, not trying to do too much mass psychology, but like we saw in the primary last night that his numbers were really low in Appalachia and Youngstown. And I mean, his name is Vivek Ramaswamy. And so, you know, I think if he were running against Tim Ryan, the race would be over right now.
That Tim Ryan would easily win this race. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
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 But I don't know, you know, people want to point to racism against Vivek Ramaswamy, but like sexism is still real. Like, let's not forget what we were attributing 2016 and 2024 to.
Right.
And I was shocked when I went to her website and it's Dr. Amy Acton, just in case you forgot.
Right. But it seems as if she's just going to lean in on that as a sign of, I am not a politician. I am somebody outside of that world of normal politics. So you can't attach me to whatever crazy stuff Democrats politically do, and I was sitting next to a Republican governor that whole time, remember? I wasn't sitting next to a leftist liberal governor. I was sitting next to Mike DeWine. But it is quite interesting. I've been saying for a while that it's like, you basically have the Mike DeWine type candidate in the Senate race and the J.D. Vance type candidate in the gubernatorial race. And that is a flip from where we've been these last few years in Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely, and Amy Acton has a great life story. She's from Youngstown. She grew up poor. I think, you know, suburban women are really going to love her candidacy. But if COVID had never happened, I think she would be running away with this race.
I take your point, which is when the ads start running, reminding people in the places where right now Ramaswamy is not running as strong as a traditional Republican would be, like you said, Youngstown, Appalachia, and just the ads come up about, here's a woman who, right, she closed our school, she told us what we could do and not do, all of that. That is going to hit much harder there than it will in suburban Columbus and in Dayton, et cetera. So if we just want to close then on your big picture thoughts on where things go from here. We are now, aren't we officially less than 200 days, I think, from the election? Tell us your thinking right now on, okay, where the president needs to be if Republicans are going to feel a little less depressed by the time the fall comes, and what Democrats need to see for them to feel like, okay, we maybe can do this Senate-House flip thing.
Yeah, so it's actually become more interesting in both cases recently. So like the Senate, I mean, I think the Democrats just need more of the same, right? Like Trump unpopular. I think if this war ends, however it ends, gas prices drop, you know, maybe his job approval gets back up to 42-43%.
I agree with that. Yep. Yep.
The House is super interesting. So I went through and counted, and if on your page, if Democrats won all the leans Democrat toss up and leans Republican seats right now, they'd have like 234 seats. But you start working it backwards then. Okay, what if the Virginia map fails? And we're talking 231. Let's say the Florida map performs like some Republicans hope it will. You're down to 227. Let's say Louisiana and Alabama and Tennessee are 5 seats for Republicans. Well, now you're down to, if they sweep all of the toss-up and lean seats, it's 222. And I don't know. I mean, the toss-ups tend to lean heavily one way or the other, but I wouldn't bet money on the Democrats sweeping them. So the House has gotten potentially more interesting, and we've done a fair amount of dooming on this. I'll do one for the road, which is, you know, you can start to see a situation where Democrats win the popular vote by like 5 points and don't get the House. And
well, that would be That would be quite something. And I guess that goes to the question of whether, and in my mind, two things would need to happen. The first is that Republican performance in places like South Texas and South Florida look more like 2024 than 2020, right? And so that's how you hold on. In those heavily Latino areas in what is ostensibly, right, a much worse year. Then you're right, the Virginia map is a big piece of this. But then you think, well, if Trump is at 42 now, or maybe a better way to say this, if the generic ballot is somewhere between 8, let's call it 6 and 10, somewhere in there. Let's give it an 8. You know, that means that Trump districts that he won by less than 10 now come into play. And even Trump 12 districts for Republicans who aren't paying much attention become problematic. But you are bringing up a really important point, which is that there just is a higher floor and a lower ceiling for Democrats than I think sometimes people appreciate. And redistricting is only going to make that ceiling a little bit lower and that floor a little bit higher. And even if Democrats were to sweep, and I've never seen this ever happen, but if they swept every district Trump carried by less than 10, that gets them 28 seats, which is not, I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. But it's very hard to win a seat that the opposite party carried by more than 5 points. You just don't see it all that often, right?
Right. To use Cook PVI, like my rule of thumb in wave elections has always been like, you start to nibble at like the D+4, D+5. You can go back and check out 2010 and 2014 and 2022, and that's kind of the top of the wave. And even 2018, I don't think Jared Golden, I think barely won his seat, but that's a weird one. That's one where the texture still matters. I don't think Democrats really went beyond the R+5 seats.
Exactly. Exactly. Even in 2010, look, all those gains in 2010, those 63 seats that Republicans picked up, those were in districts that Obama lost or won by less than 5. 61 of those pickups were in those districts. So it is hard to go, or not 61 total, but anyway, the lion's share of those were in those specific districts. So it is very hard to win in those double-digit districts. Sean, this has been great. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today. And as I said to anybody who wants to understand both redistricting and have a sober, smart look at our politics, you got to follow. Sean, how do they follow you?
It's just Sean Trendy, at Sean Trendy on X Twitter. And you can also see my writing, Real Clear Politics.
Perfect. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here anytime.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Coffey.